All right, everyone, welcome to the live stream. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I have a very special guest with me, Kyle Chassé, and I'm gonna bring him on right now. Hello, Kyle.
Hey, what's happening, man?
Oh, okay, give me one second. I was afraid of this. I need to put my headphones onto the computer. Pardon this. Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay, perfect. Welcome. Welcome to Steak Podcast. Thank you so much for your time, agreeing to come on. And I'm just going to jump right into it because I know your time is very valuable. I know a lot more about you than you do about me. I've watched all of your live streams, I've watched all the interviews on YouTube. And I want to start because I want to make sure that we're talking about new things, right? I want to try to get to know the man behind. The man behind House of Dao, the man behind Paid Ignition. I want to try to get an understanding of how your mind thinks. I want to take it back to kind of the progression of how this interview will go for everyone in the audience and for anyone who's watching. I'm going to ask Kyle questions. If you guys have questions as they come up, please drop them in the live chat and we'll try to get to them at the end. But I kind of want to go, beginning, present, and future, and start in the beginning. I know you got into crypto around 2012, but I'd love to learn more about, Kyle before then. Where are you from? What's your educational background? Was there anything in your past that kind of led you to know very early on that entrepreneurship and technology was, the path you were headed down?
Cool. Yeah, so I mean I'm let me just mute these other things that are happening over here. Yeah, so I'm from California originally, and yeah, sort of meeting these things. Yeah, from California originally. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I just knew, like, there was just a lot of things that I didn't really subscribe to, that were kind of, that seemed to be the general narrative of what other people were doing. For example, I remember that I remember in, like, after was it after yeah like summer after I graduated high school, or whenever it was, maybe it was senior year or something like that, when people were getting their, whatever it is that like students get their acceptance letters from colleges, universities. I just remember being at my friend's house and, like, them running out to the mailbox, excited to get, like, a letter for, like, a college application or something, and just really just being confused about when people did these applications and things, because it was just never something that was on my mind. For me, all I wanted to do after high school was go travel, through Europe. So I did a couple of backpacking trips, two of them different through Europe, then one through Southeast Asia, through Thailand and Laos, Cambodia, things like that. And thought I was going to do that for a while, and then in between each different trip, I always had jobs that, paid really well, like sales jobs. Like, I sold cell phones, worked at a gym, sold gym memberships, and that was the best way that I could go travel again, was just basically, staying at my parents' house, making good money doing sales. And then, and both times I came back between trips, I tried college. So I tried going to college, like the junior college in Santa Barbara, and like I really enjoyed going there. Actually, it's a beautiful campus, like, nice to be there. I paid attention in class, but after, I stacked my classes so it was happening on, like, 2 days a week, like Tuesday and Thursday. And after school, I went to my job to make money, and then would go home, live my life or whatever, go back to my job or whatever it was. And then I would forget the night before school that I, like, had school again the next day. So then I just wake up and go back to school. I never really did my homework or studied for tests or anything. So I just kind of went to school to go to school and enjoyed being there. But when it came time to check grades and things like that, I never checked my grades. Both times I tried to go to, two times I tried to go to junior college, and it just didn't really work. So after my trip to Southeast Asia, I kind of felt like I should do something. So I got in. So I did go to some, like, kind of accelerated school that was geared toward teaching people how to do business. And they did that. So then after that, you know, I just knew that I never wanted to go to university. I never wanted to be somebody who was applying for a job to a boss so I could show them my fancy university degree that would have to like be, you know, work for them forever. I felt like I definitely wanted to be my own boss. And so, so that's kind of my, you know, my background. Grew up in California. And you know, after this kind of accelerated business school, I went and got a real estate license and started selling commercial real estate. Okay. And that was good. That was good until 2008, financial crash, and everything kind of froze. Like I had in 2006, when I had a really good year, I was like, oh, this is, I didn't love it, but I liked it.
Yeah.
And so I thought that, you know, this is something that I could definitely do. I thought it'd be good money, you know, really good money for the first year out of kind of like as a career, whatever. And then that happened. And that's when I kind of got into the entrepreneurship and starting businesses and, you know, trial and error, went through some different things. And, yeah, I guess that's kind of the background.
Yeah, no, this is actually a perfect place to interject because I know that a lot of your past experiences in business, kind of have formed and shaped the way you've thought about, you know, creating paid network and how you've structured it. And we'll get into that. But before we do, maybe you could just briefly kind of talk about, you know, 2012 when you first found Bitcoin and kind of how you fell down the rabbit hole of this, you know, digital asset, blockchain space, NFT DAOs, all of it, how you fell down that, you know, rabbit hole.
So I guess there was something, you know, because I didn't subscribe to like the general narrative, you know, I didn't really quite get it. Like people, you know, were so programmatic. It felt like you know, the university and the voting, and just the voting never really kind of made sense to me either. It was like, this whole system is rigged. You know, I mean, I live in California, so, it really doesn't matter. I thought I've got better things to do with my time than go stand in line to make a vote that doesn't count at the end of the day. And for anyone who doesn't really understand what I mean by that, you know, if you live in California, it's always a Democratic Electoral College vote. So it literally does not matter who you vote for. And people still feel they need to go wait in line to go do it. And I really liked, you know, I mean, a lot of things that make sense to me. And I really liked, you know, these quote unquote conspiracy theories. Like, I'm like, well, this sounds pretty legit. Like, how come you guys don't have answers for these things? Like the 9/11 thing, like, yeah, you know, okay, maybe it's pretty far fetched, but at the same time, like, they're asking some pretty good questions that you guys could at least answer for us, you know? And then I watched a film one time called The Zeitgeist, and that, you know, that told me about the Federal Reserve and the money printing and how that was a rigged system, you know, a system built on debt. So these were before 2012. These are things I learned, you know, early on, and kind of frustrated me about the system in America, but again, felt powerless, you know, like, what can you do? You know, what can you do as a citizen? You can't really do anything. Your really vote doesn't count, you're powerless. You know, even everything is designed to be, and especially in like a huge system like that, it's designed to kind of stay the same. It doesn't really matter who's president, to be honest with you. Like, it doesn't matter if it's Trump or Biden or Bush or Clinton, nothing really has changed. You know, my entire life, I didn't matter who was president. Like my parents and myself, we lived the same exact way. So I learned about Bitcoin in 2012 from Silk Road. It was just, so my buddy showed me it and I was just like fascinated. The first time I went on the dark web, I was like, man, what is this? I felt like I was breaking laws just by going on the dark web, you know?
Yeah.
But it was interesting, you know, the whole thing fascinated me. It wasn't just Bitcoin alone. In fact, it wasn't even Bitcoin at that time that really fascinated me. It was more the dark web that fascinated me. But so that was the first exposure to Bitcoin. And then in 2013, this whole thing with WikiLeaks happened where, you know, that were basically, you know, they do the thing that they try to do all the time when they don't like what you're doing, you know. And for a nonprofit like WikiLeaks, what they try to do was cut off all the payment rails to their nonprofit. So Visa, MasterCard, the banks, you know, Western Union, all these guys said, hey, no more contributions to WikiLeaks as a nonprofit that didn't have any money. That would really, really hurt them. But Bitcoin existed at this time. And so someone said, hey, try Bitcoin. And money could start flowing in again. And I saw this happen. And this is my big aha moment when I realized for the first time ever, people were able to circumvent the central powers that are controlling everything.
Yeah, no, I completely agree and completely understand, especially your sentiments around the system and how you felt like this was an opportunity to move outside of that system. And I want to go, before we jump right in, this actually is the lead into paid network, because I kind of want to understand a little bit more about the genesis story and kind of the inception around paid network. And what was your motivation? I know that you have Master Ventures, which maybe you can also just kind of give a breakdown for the listeners, you know, Master Ventures and its relationship to paid network, and then House of DAO, and kind of the triangle of the three.
I mean, that's a lot to go into, man.
Yeah.
But
the high level, very high level, because I want to focus on paid network.
Yeah, I mean, so I've been, you know, like I've been thinking about like a revolution for a long time because of this whole idea. Like, I want to make change. I want to disrupt the system, but it can't really be done, you know, in a big system that's meant to not be disrupted. So that's why I left the States.
What year was that?
That was 2017. So a lot of this is, you know, keep in mind, this is kind of how I grew up. A lot of this is in the back of my mind. I thought blockchain was key, you know, especially when we started thinking about looking at DAOs and things like that. So like with, you know, even with Ethereum, you know, back in like early 2015, we're starting to see like how this DAO is forming and the decentralized governance idea. And that was like a whole new paradigm shift of like, wow, we can actually have a decentralized governance structure. In more so ways than Bitcoin allows. So basically, you know, since 2013, I started building, and to do high level, I've done everything in the space from, you know, advising, investing, incubating, you know, finance, like institutional investing, building token economics, marketing, PR, whatever. And so I've been doing that for a long time. And when things started to pick up and I needed more help for these kind of things, I started building up Master Ventures, which was investment of my own personal capital and advisory and incubation. And so, and then 2019, I wanted to start building our own projects in-house. I've been in the space for, you know, 7 years at this point. I had seen a lot of different projects go to market. I helped a lot of projects go to market. And I felt confident that we could bring our own project to market. So I'm focused a lot on infrastructure. Like, what do we need to make this adoption thing happen? And so the first thing that Master Ventures built, Master Ventures is the first company in crypto company that I started, is Crypto Exchange Alliance, which, you know, the tech took us like the whole concept I've been working on for like 2 or 3 years. And the tech just finished on that. So we have another team now working for this. This is non-crypto. It's an equity-based company that's like a infrastructure for exchanges. And because that idea, we already did the validation and the product market fit and things like that. I had some time, you know, last year, 2020, middle of the year, still kind of bear market vibes. I had, you know, I'm in this court case that I've been in now for 5 years. Let's see, 2020. So that had been 4 years at that point. It'll be 5 years in August. So, so I've done a lot of different agreements with people in my career, a lot of different business agreements, contracts. And most of the time they go okay, but there's been a few times that they haven't gone okay. And one of them, you know, back with this guy that I was going to enter into some business with in 2016, he committed fraud and I was investing into his company. And so, I could have just walked away from it or whatever, but I know this guy has a history of being a con and committing fraud, and I felt like a moral obligation to kind of go after him. You know, that's when I learned the lessons of the inefficiencies, I mean, of the entire court systems and the civil legal systems, attorneys and things like that. You know, this is now almost 5 years later, hundreds of thousands of dollars later, and still not dealt with, you know, and talking to other people. Everybody has these stories, you know, and when you're doing a deal with someone and they screw you over, they violate the terms of the agreement, you don't have recourse. You don't really have anything you can do. It just doesn't exist. It's a really weird system. So we still have people, we're still super comfortable doing these agreements every day. And some people who haven't been through this experience think that this agreement covers them in some way or fashion. But the fact of the matter is this really complicated legal agreement doesn't really do much for you, because if I screw you over and you have this piece of paper, good luck coming after me. I'm just going to be disobedient. I'm not going to show up to court. You know, maybe you might win a judgment against me, but good luck getting me to pay you.
Yeah.
You know, just ignore it. That's the easiest way for people to do it. Just let the person try to go through. They're going to spend so much time and effort and legal fees and headache. They're just going to give up sooner or later. And then you talk to people in other countries like India, whose court system is like 1,000 years backed up. Forget it. It's not even possible. Africa. I talked to guys over there in Africa. Everything's so corrupt over there that, you know, it doesn't even matter if you're right or wrong, because somebody just pays someone off and you're screwed anyway in that situation. Like, the whole thing is messed up everywhere. So I realized this and just thinking, well, you know, there must be a way more efficient way for us to do business, you know, but just why aren't we doing it? And that was kind of the inception of Paid Network.
Yeah, no, I'm very thankful. That was, you painted the perfect picture. And that can set the framework for our discussion going forward, which, for those of them who are in the audience who may not know, I am a 1L at the University of Oklahoma. So very interested in the law, very interested in legal disruption. I first came across Paid Network through Mr. Business on Twitter. He was talking about, you know, he runs Spectre Group. I don't know if you're familiar, but he was talking about D-Law. And when I saw this, I became extraordinarily interested. I've always, as I've been exploring this space since 2017, I'm of the class of 2017. I've always kind of been thinking, you know, this technology allows for so much disruption. And in your experience in real estate, right? I'm a real estate agent as well. So it's like you have the title company, you have the lender, you have the agent, the broker, and everyone's just getting a little piece of it. And I'm, you know, working on my second deal now, and things have started to go a little sour on this deal. And you start realizing, like, there is no recourse. There absolutely, like, you know, earnest money, at best, you might get a mediation and get it split. So it's like, there's no way to punish bad actors, and there's no way for people's reputation to, you know, at least be manifested. And you've kind of highlighted that in just your anecdotal narrative there. You have an experience with the law, and like, I'm a complete legal outsider. Like, I you know, don't come from a legal background necessarily, other than my education. And so you have a very unique experience as a businessman. Those pain points that you've just discussed, you know, as we think about how software is eating the world, you know, Bitcoin is eating banks, I see Paid Network literally as eating some of the transactional flow of corporate attorneys, because my understanding is, you know, the software works by creating smart agreements that use very simple language. There's a reputation scoring system. There's going to be arbitrators. Maybe you can just talk about some of the mechanics of that network and maybe how you see how you've designed the network to maybe integrate itself or maybe completely disrupt the current sort of legal structures, if you will.
Sure. You know, I mean, people are we're so programmed to believe that, you know, that things are done in a certain way. And really the legal agreements process has been so inundated in us that we really like miss the big picture of how simple it is to make an agreement with one another, you know, like, and a lot, I spoke to these two guys that are film producers from France. They just wanted to have a chat with me the other day, talk about the problem that they were having doing, you know, co-producing films on a global level. And, you know, they said they're asking me, like, well, you know, what happens? Like, don't you think that you need arbitrators that have a unique expertise in a certain vertical? And I thought, well, let's talk through some examples, because I thought about this a lot. And I believe that your average person typically has the competency to tell who's right or who's wrong in a situation. I said, let's walk through some examples, you know, because usually it's like, you know, okay, you guys agreed to this thing and that guy's going to pay you this much to deliver that thing on this date. Typically, that's kind of how agreements are. I mean, you know, some of them are a little bit different, but like that's usually what it is. And it's either the person delivered or they didn't. They're late or they're not. They have a valid reason or they don't. And these things are really, really usually pretty obvious to tell, like who was right or who was wrong in the situation. So whenever we negotiate a deal, the deal's done in layman's English, very simple terms. In fact, it's like bullet point types of terms. But for some reason, when we go to sign this deal, we then feel a need to put it in some super complicated, very long legal agreement. Why do we do that? Well, I don't know. It's just the way that things are done, you know? But no, what if we made deals the same kind of context of the way that we negotiated them? So instead of being 15 pages of legalese, it's a half a page or one page or some bullet points, a very, very simple agreement. And then, you know, create this, what we're calling these smart agreements, which are basically just kind of like a full feature set. You know, you have the standard agreement that this kind of like that you're using, standardized kind of almost template that just fills out all your information. And then if things change, like in the course of our life, like let's say that I'm going to build a website for you. And I tell you that I'm going to have it done in 2 weeks and it's going to cost $5,000. So we agree on that. We agree that it's going to be one page. It's going to have these sections, whatever. You put the money in escrow. I start doing work. I told you I was going to deliver it in 2 weeks. But all of a sudden, like, all of a sudden something happened. Like, you know, my mom died or something. So then I'm like, hey, so then I would be like, hey, man, listen, is it cool if I get it to you a few days later because I have this family emergency I need to attend to? And you just might say, yeah, that's fine. It's okay. And so we can have this immutable transaction messaging in the app because sometimes agreements change and people understand that, you know? Or at that point, you could have said, hey, no, I really need it done. Like, I need you to give me money back so I can move on and find somebody else, you know? Or maybe you were cool with that. But either way, like, it's all in a message history so we can see the communication. And if then I went and attended to my family emergency, and then you said, hey, dude, you said you were going to, in the contract, you said you were going to give it to me by this date. And I said, yeah, but you told me I could. So then you want to open a dispute. Then we have these decentralized arbitrators who can come and look at the evidence uploaded by the two parties. They can see the transaction or the communication history and see what our communication was. So it's like having all these tools, the escrow, the communication between the two parties on an immutable type of ledger where the conversation history is tracked. So we can keep track of these really important points that really could change the terms of that initial agreement, which you don't really have in standard legal agreements either, because you and I can make an agreement. We can hop on the phone, talk about something else. I think that you are cool with these terms, but then we just have this piece of paper in the legacy world that says, no, it's not in writing. So I think the whole platform that we're building is much, much better on so many levels. And it just, you know, disputes should be settled in a quick and efficient way without a whole, but it shouldn't take a lot of your time and effort in your life because we're all busy. We all have things to do. You know, nobody has time to go deal with the traditional legacy court system world. Nobody has that time.
And so many questions, and I'm just going to just start diving into them. But how are arbitrators chosen?
Yep. So it will be, so you, first of all, you will have to be staking a significant amount of paid, and this goes like in game theory where, you know, we believe that if you hold a lot of your assets in that native token and paid token, you're going to want to do what's best for the ecosystem. So you're going to want to be a good actor. And so we will have, this will be a position that people can, you know, basically stake their way into. And we're using Chainlink's VRF, which is a way on a decentralized system to verifiably, it's called verifiable random function. Basically, it's RNG. It randomly chooses people out of a selection. So the arbitrators will be chosen at random, three of them, to look at the evidence, and they will be anonymous. They won't know who each other are, and the people in the dispute won't know who they are. And if we can help it, they won't know who the parties having the dispute are either. But that may be hard to hide based on the evidence that's uploaded.
And I want to make sure I understand. So let's say I entered into agreement with Bob, and Bob lives in California. So I'm going to deposit some maybe paid tokens, maybe Bitcoin or Ethereum into an agreement as collateral. He's going to do the same. They go into this escrow contract. You know, a dispute arises, it gets arbitrated, a decision's rendered, and at that point, the agreement will kind of automatically, based off the arbitrators, disperse the funds to the party who they decide it belongs to, correct?
Yeah, so the escrow will be in like a multi-sig wallet. So either the person, it's the same way that like if anyone of you have ever used like Paxful or local Bitcoins or whatever, or even the dark market for that matter, it's the person who, you know, is receiving the service, has the right to then release the funds to the person that, the person that was paying, or the arbitrators have the ability to release those funds to one party or another as well.
Okay. So what I really like about this is I see parallels between, you know, everyone talks about Bitcoin as apolitical money and removing power from the state. And, you know, the legal elite might not like this, but it's essentially like software is replacing the powers that have traditionally been reserved for the state. Would you agree? In some ways?
In some ways, because we're not disrupting criminal laws, right? We're not disrupting like, you know, some of the really important laws that are being created. We're not disrupting laws, for example. We're disrupting business agreements. So it's more like really removing that because, like, you know, it's ridiculous that the court. I believe the court and the judicial system should be used for criminal types of behavior, like, you know, that are really serious, and like civil disputes should be handled, you know, out of that system because it's way too inefficient. So, you know, I think that there's a lot to work on in the actual like legislative and legal system when it comes down to lobbying and laws, and like that needs to be disrupted for sure. You know, this was a personal pain point for, and really I know for all business people around the world.
Would you agree with the assessment that the strength of the network relies in the trust and the, I guess maybe the, not the trust, that's not the right word, but at least the credibility of people's faith in the arbitrators?
Yeah, would I say that the strength of the network relies in the credibility of the arbitrators? That was the question?
Yes, sir. Right?
Yeah, so this is something that, you know, so we've thought about this quite a bit. You know, it's in order for it to be a decentralized system, you have to kind of, you kind of have to trust that that's going to be the case, you know, but it's going to require a significant amount of paid tokens, a significant amount, in order to qualify to become an arbitrator in the system, meaning that, you know, your average person can't do it. So, you know, the goal, and I really don't see why people would want to do it either unless they kind of took it somewhat seriously, considering the fact that their value is at stake, right? So let's say that somebody had to put up $250,000, for example, of paid tokens to become an arbitrator. It's a lot of money. And the last thing that they want to do is have people start bitching and complaining about how useless the arbitration system is within paid network. If that's the case, you know, their money's locked. It's at stake. And if people start losing trust because the arbitration system is horrible and there's no justice being served, people are going to start losing faith in the system, and, you know, selling their tokens, price will drop, you know, demand will drop. You know, supply will become more abundant, and people who have their value locked will be losing value. So again, this comes back to game theory. So it really does depend on the quality of arbitrators that come in. You know, there's things that I've thought about, to prevent bad actors in that position. Like, let's say that you got three arbitrators that are always called on every type of case, but one guy, because we'll keep track of the arbitrators who voted yes, who voted no, who voted Bob, who voted Alice. And if there's one person that constantly is voting against the other two in many, many situations, you have to kind of start to look at this person, and maybe we'll have another arbitrator or another group of arbitrators look at the kind of track record of this person and saying, like, this guy clearly isn't, he's making his decisions, or she's making their decisions based on, in 1 minute, they have obviously haven't looked at the evidence. They're just doing it carelessly, you know? And if that's the case, they're also at stake of losing they're also at risk of losing their stake.
Yeah. So as I started thinking about this network, and, you know, I'm kind of going to get, I don't know if you watch Marty Bent's Tales from the Crypt, but he always talks about getting a little cosmic. So pardon if we get a little cosmic here. When I first started thinking about paid network, you know, I'm always just thinking about how I can kind of break outside of the normal rules. And I can really see this kind of system being adopted by, I mean, the next generation of attorneys being arbitrators, you know, people who want to, like, I was just a part attending your live stream, and you were talking about, I mean, this is a way that the way you, you know, imagine it is it could be a career for people in terms of, you know, participating, staking. And I say all this just to say, who do you imagine as being some of the first early adopters? Do you imagine it being, you know, big law firms who are trying to provide good service? Because I see it's a value proposition. Like, I think about it like this. If I come into Oklahoma, you know, there's three big law firms, maybe two in Oklahoma. If I start a new firm and I, you know, put myself on a value proposition to my customers of, hey, look, I'm using technology that's going to save you money ultimately, so you should be my client, because by adopting this technology up front, yes, this is new, but like what we're actually doing is we're saving you money in the long run, because by having done this, you're going to make your business so much more efficient. You're going to have to deal with lawyers less. And so it's like, I think that the incentives of big law firms is to keep the system as it is now. And so I'm interested to hear your thoughts are, do you imagine that this is going to be, you know, freelancers who adopt it? Is it going to be esports people? Is it going to be, you know, influencers who are doing business with, you know, everyone international? I mean, you talked about the film guy. Do you see it being big law lawyers? Who do you imagine stepping in? And honestly, maybe you could even give me some advice on like, hey, like I'm a small bag holder of paid, like, you know, I'm obviously paying student loans to go to law school, but like would really want to do something like this. So maybe you can just give some of your insights there.
Yeah, I mean, the low hanging fruit is everybody in the crypto industry. You know, that's the easiest because we still need, you know, anybody outside of crypto is going to have to get used to the idea of using digital currency to do anything. What is staking? You know, what am I paying for the service for? Blah blah blah. But I think that, you know, that's also why I'm really excited about today, because it's so much more mainstream than it was even in 2017. You know, certainly a hell of a lot more than 2013 when I tried to do the Bitcoin lottery. You know, so. It's something, and along with this comes central bank digital currencies, which is going to be shoved down everyone's throat soon enough. You know, China's already rolling it out. The states are talking about it. Everyone's doing their own, which will get everybody used to using a digital currency. When this happens, everybody will be used to using digital currency, which means that everybody will be familiar with using crypto apps. At that point, paid network becomes a lot more feasible for every industry. In the meantime, you know, crypto is growing. Blockchain, last I looked at it, was like 85% year over year, probably a bit more now. So if we could just start natively in this industry, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, it's huge industry already, but it's still small compared to things. So, you know, I see it. I mean, we've already got a ton of partnerships on board of people who want to use this stuff already. Everybody I talk to, you know, feels me on the pain points here and just says like, yeah, I mean, you know, every single time that we sign an agreement, it's useless. It's pointless. People ask me if I want to sign an NDA. I was like, dude, come on. You and I both know it's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's pointless. So, you know, we like one of our advisors, Yori, he's on board, you know, helping us a ton for everything. But one of the reasons that we took him on specifically was because he has experience doing enterprise contracts, the modular contracts for big enterprises like Shell and things like that. And so probably in Q3 of this year, maybe Q4, after the full kind of mainnet rolls out for small, medium businesses, we want to tackle the enterprise business world as well. So I don't think that there's any industry that couldn't benefit from using a system like we're building. The only exception might be for sums that are tremendous, you know, like let's say, because there becomes a point when there's enough money on the line, or maybe enough complexity on the line, that you might need a traditional like lawyer, like legal type thing, where there's millions and millions of dollars at stake, then maybe. But at the same time, if you're really rich. And it's normal for you to do a deal for a couple million bucks. And even if it goes south, you'd rather trust paid network than lawyers and 5 years of your time and hundreds of thousands of dollars legal fees. Maybe you use it anyway, you know. But again, it's just like it's just a better system, you know. And we're building redundancies into it as well. So if you're unhappy with the first result from the first set of arbitrators, you could stake more tokens to get a second, you know, a kind of an appeal of sorts, where another set come in and take a look as well.
Okay, that was one of my questions as well. So thank you for that. I want to transition now a little bit to talking about, you know, Ignition and some of the projects that are being launched on top of Paid Network. So as I learned and started researching you and your company more, it seems like Paid Network, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in Master Ventures and House of DAO, it seems like there's almost this trilemma where, you know, you have your venture studio, and House of DAO, for the listeners, is kind of an incubation venture. I believe the location is in Thailand, but it's this really cool, very forward-thinking way of doing work, where people can come and collab. You know, you stake your tokens to get access to the venture studio. You could stay there, be with awesome people. So just super, super, super cool. And Paid, I see these projects that are being launched on Ignition as like all part of this big ecosystem, whereby people who participate in the network, it's almost like being part of a republic in a weird way, if that makes sense. And so I'm interested to hear your thoughts about, well, before we get too cosmic, I just want to hear about, you know, tell us about Ignition, tell us about Shadows, the projects that are launching on top of, and sort of what is your mission there, and yeah.
So I've always wanted to, like, I saw what happened. I take this industry, like, I have a lot of fun, but I take it very seriously. Like, it's my life, you know. And I sold my company, like I told you before, in 2013, bought Bitcoin. And by late 2015, early 2016, I realized I would have to work again in my life if I never wanted to. But I tried not working for a while and realized that was life I didn't want to live either. It was super boring, you know. And I love this industry. Yeah. So basically where was it going? I totally forgot. But, I have this history of really high quality. Oh yeah. I remember what I was going to say. I want this space to be taken seriously and for people to not get hurt in this industry, you know, like financially wrecked. And in 2017, we saw a lot of this, a lot of scams, and really, and you also saw projects that just raised a lot of money that maybe initially their intention wasn't to be a scam, but they raised $50 million and things got a little hard. And so they just said, well, I'll just give up. At least I have $49 million left. And so, you know, why do I need to work anymore? This is a really big problem, and it made a really, really big, bad impression on a lot of people about our space at the time. So I've always wanted to, Vitalik came up with this idea of like a DICO model, which is like a, you know, decentralized autonomous ICO, basically a crowdfunding platform with a governance structure, but it basically holds accountable a project after they raise money to make sure that it continues to deliver in order to continue to receive funds. And so this, ever since I heard this beautiful idea, because I love crowdfunding, I'll just go back a little bit to my history. Like, you know, when I was trying to be a young entrepreneur back in the day and start thinking about a business and like, oh, you need to go raise money. How do you do that? You go to an angel and you go to a VC. And by the time the VC takes over, you've got 15% of your company left and they make all the decisions. I'm like, that doesn't sound like my company anymore. So I always thought like, so crowdfunding came along. That's an amazing idea. You know, amazing idea. You can get a bunch of people from all over the world who just have a little bit of money to invest in you to give it to you, believe in you, and give them an opportunity to reap the rewards if you do really well. That's a beautiful idea. And you don't have to give up control of the company, for example, or the idea as a crowdfunding model. So I've always wanted to do this. And the idea of Paid Network came out, you know, initially, and we built the MVP for it, but there's a long way to go before we build up the main net for Paid Network for the legal agreement side of things, or the smart agreement side of things. Well, I've been in the space long enough to know how important it is as a product to stay relevant and in front of people's faces on a regular basis. We cannot have a full-fledged DICO model or, you know, community governed crowdfunding model until we have things like arbitration, escrow, and governance in place, which again is probably going to take us 6 to 9 months to build out. So in the meantime, let's take the simple version or the ungoverned version of the DICO model, the crowdfunding model, and let's launch Ignition. That way, in a bull market, we can stay relevant and use the experience that we have from Master Ventures and myself of sourcing deals, you know, since 2014, and bring that to our community, you know, and give them an opportunity to participate in some of the highest quality projects that are launching, you know, moving forward. So I think that one thing that that sets us apart is my background, my background, my team's background, and, you know, the history and the track record for Master Ventures. You know, so Master Ventures, if you go to our website under portfolio, you know, it's very transparent of what we've invested into. And I mean, it's an impressive portfolio. It's a good track record. And I think that's one of the things that definitely distinguishes us from any other type of crowdfunding platform or IDO platform where, you know, you have that experience. And we vet projects before they launch, you know, and we make sure that they have a team. We make sure that we know who that team is. We make sure that they have some type of code written. We make sure that, you know, that has a like a good use case. We look at the token metrics. We make sure that, like, you know, we set it up in a way that, like, I would want to invest in this project. I would want to participate in it.
Yeah.
And I believe it's going to do really well in the future, you know. And in fact, like, Master Ventures often does.
Yeah.
Or so far, I think that, you know, everything that we've lined up for, we have, you know, invested
skin
into.
In the game.
So
yeah.
We're leading this, and then we're offering, you know, and then we're going to launch it on Ignition. So we have skin in the game of everything that we put out to the community.
I from watching from afar, I just appreciate how much integrity you have in the way you operate, in your constant communication and being, you know, transparent with everything, and like maybe arguably too much at times, you know, like you really like alpha leaks. I really highly encourage people to, you know, subscribe to your channel, and I'll have all that in the description. I'm going to take these last, you know, we got about maybe 10 more minutes, hopefully, unless you have to run. Do you have 10 more minutes?
I got it. It's fine.
Okay. I want to take some time to be maybe a little selfish, because I think you're just so smart, and I've heard your advice to young attorneys. I want to hear your advice to me. Like I do. Like, I, you know, I'm some, you kind of get a sense of what I'm about, what I'm interested in. You know, I'm a 1L. I'm really trying to do something new. I care a lot about this space as well. And maybe if you can try to generalize it as well, but I mean, I want to be extremely selfish right now and ask, you know, what is your advice to me?
What's a 1L?
It means you're in your first year of law school. It means you know nothing.
Okay.
You got 3 years. So I got 2 more years.
You got two more years.
Okay. And so what I've kind of been structuring in my head is kind of what I've heard you talk about, like, you know, the Staked podcast, is my platform for being able to learn, to talk to people, create my own personal brand, but also to, you know, the advice I've heard you've given is, you know, this industry is just so new. If you're a lawyer, you can go and kind of skip all this, just by going and going to a conference, handing out your business card, being like, this is what I want to do. So if you can maybe even give me the next level deeper, like, you know, that next hack that will really prepare me. So when I'm ready to do that I'm ready.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. So Mike Miglio, he's the CEO of Bridge Mutual. Mike, when I met Mike, like, he's young, man, like probably fresh out of law school, but he didn't care, man. He just went to, that's exactly what he did. He just went to, like, it's exactly what he went to a conference. That's what I'm pretty sure that's where I met him. I can't remember now. It was a while ago. But he's like, yeah, I'm a crypto attorney. I'm like, damn, cool. Like, there wasn't hardly any around. And especially if it was, you know, if it was someone that was maybe a little bit more affordable than the $700 an hour guy, that, because there's only one big firm in town that's doing it. But regardless, everybody in the industry needs some type of crypto attorney. And dude, man, I'll tell you what, you know, we're trying to set up a fund for Master Ventures right now. So Master Ventures up until this point has been private equity, you know, my money. But for the first time, we're actually now trying to set up an LP fund, you know, a proper venture fund. And it is so complicated. Like, you can't even, you know, I can't get a straight answer from anybody, you know, oh, you got to do this and that. And it's super complicated and blah, blah, blah. It's a nightmare. I'm like, man, I know a bunch of people want to give me money right now so I can invest it for them. Like, just tell me how to do that. And they're like, oh, well, you can take crypto, you know, take cash. I was like, I don't even want to take cash. Oh, that's even more complicated. If you want to take crypto, fuck. Like, you know, this is so there's, anyway, that's my little rant, because I'm like, you know, dealing with these guys again, these lawyers again.
Yeah. they're the worst. real estate agents and lawyers are literally some of the worst. And I'm like, I'm in both these industries. I don't know what it says about me, but
don't forget a used car salesman then.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, then, like, so for you, you know, what I would do if I were you is just take your time in law school to learn law, but specifically apply it toward crypto, you know? So when you come out, cause that's super useful, you know, like, to, even if you wanted to start your own company, like, to make sure that you could just do all your own legal stuff and not have to retain that attorney, setting up your jurisdictions, making sure, knowing what you can and cannot do, And there's so much that you can do with it, but just apply everything that you're doing with that mindset of what you're going to do, you know, and take the time while you're learning to learn, like, what kind of niche you kind of want to be in as a crypto attorney as well. I can't really tell you which kind of niche you should pick, or if that's what you really want to do is law, but, like, it just also just seems like more interesting, because you're really, you know, you're really just giving people advice in crypto of, like, yeah, you can and cannot say that, you can and cannot do this. There's not really a whole bunch of, like, litigation, it seems like. You know, maybe focusing on international law is probably a lot more important than domestic law. You know, I mean, my advice for everybody is just ignore the United States altogether. Yeah. Like, why would you want to? There's so much money and business in the rest of the world. If you're going to, the one country that's going to mess with you severely if you do something, that if you so much as sell a token to an American, like, they can come after you.
Yeah.
You know, so international law would be much more relevant, you know, considering that you're interested in crypto. But in a more general perspective, yeah, you know, that's the thing. It's like, exactly, you can graduate law school. COVID hopefully will be over by then. You can get, you know, go to a conference and just start handing, like, because you should be, you know, confident. You have two more years to learn, and really nobody knows what the fuck the laws are for crypto, because it's always evolving and changing, you know, every single day. So by the time that you graduate, you probably will know, you know, what the laws are at that moment and what people can and cannot do.
Yeah.
I mean, I pretty much know what the laws are, and I don't even attorney. You know, just from my attorney telling me what I can and cannot do. It's not that complicated. That's my advice. It's the same thing for every other business too. It's still a new industry, and it's still growing so fast that there's so much demand for these services in the industry. Like, You know, it's the same thing for developers. You know, like right now, if you're a developer watching this show, go learn Rust. Go learn Rust. You know,
and you would say choose Rust over Python or Java, or any Rust is the one.
Yeah, because I'm telling you, I've been trying to hire a Rust developer forever, a Rust blockchain developer.
Okay.
Sometimes I find a Rust developer that's been, you know, working for some aviation or this or that or whatever. But, you know, in 2016 and 17, if you were a Solidity developer, you were expensive. But now it's pretty common for Solidity. But now Rust is a new and Rust and blockchain together. Like, man, you can go out and, you know, you can go out and work for a software house or something. But if you go out and learn Rust and you have some crypto knowledge and you know how smart contracts work, all of a sudden you got your $200,000 a year type of position. Yeah. You know, not only that, but if you're smart, listen to me, like, don't work for, just tell, if you know, find yourself, either if you're not entrepreneurial, find a cool startup to work for that you believe in and take tokens, because that's how you take the upside. Don't take the upside is tremendous in this industry. You get behind something really good and it does well, then there's tremendous upside for it. Like, I don't even think along the lines of, you know, I've got a point in paid in Master Ventures, every single one of the employees or my team here, everyone's underpaid when it comes to a salary, but everyone's way overpaid when it comes to opportunities to participate in the deal flow that we get. For sure. So everyone should be looking at upside in this space.
No, I think that,
and you too, as an attorney, like, dude, you know how much I don't know if it's okay saying this, but like, man, our attorney made he has stupid amounts of money. He has a lot of pay tokens. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. No, I completely intend to be exactly that type of attorney. One last question, because we're running out of time here, and I'd be remiss. So a little bit of history. I know you don't really care, but Stake Podcasts started off as a Decred specific podcast. Are you familiar with Decred at all? Have you heard of this project?
Yeah, back in the day. Yeah.
Okay. I just closing question, because the dorks, that's what I call the subscribers. We're Decred dorks. So the dorks out there, we would you know, if you have any thoughts, or even if it's, I don't know. But I got to ask, because they would be remiss if I didn't. I'd be remiss if I didn't.
What's the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. What are your thoughts about Decred?
I don't know enough about it, man. I know there's I know the community is very, very sincere about it. I just honestly don't even know enough about it. Like, I know a couple times I've talked to people about it that just said, like, and it made me interested, but never got into it.
Fair enough.
Not because I didn't like it or anything, just because I never did. There's just too many out
there. Yeah, exactly. There's so much out there. And I'm very happy that I found Paid Network. I'm very excited just to continue to watch you and the company grow. Do you think House of DAO will have more than one location one day? That's my last question.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. We plan on having, you know, I always say 20 or 30, that number is just kind of thrown out there. But, you know, the idea really about House of DAO is like, it's not a place that you go visit. It's a lifestyle. You know, it's having 20 or 30 of them around the world, and the coolest places in the world, where if your dream isn't if the idea of like a white picket fence and that fairy tale life that you're told, that nobody seems to actually pull off because nobody's happy living in the same house forever, married with, you know, that I don't see that in today's world anymore. But if you subscribe to a different lifestyle, one that like you want to be surrounded by like-minded people because you're passionate about this stuff and you want to see culture and you want to travel around the world and you want to bounce, but at the same time, you know, you still want to have that kind of community vibe and still, you know, be around people that think like you, and you can leverage your networks as well. That's kind of what House of DAO is for, is to be able to live and work anywhere in the world, but still have family dinner at night.
I love it. I love it. I think that's the future of organizing humans. Kyle Chassé, thank you for your time. Anything that I didn't ask that I should have?
No, man. I think but pretty well covered it.
Okay, awesome. Well, to the dorks out there, stay staked, and see you guys in the next one.
Thanks, man.